Support for The Bittersweet Life comes from our listeners, generous people who believe that all art, including art that's an audio medium, has real value and deserves to be supported. This week, I want to thank Esta and Ed. Thank you so much for supporting this show and for being the most recent contributors over at patreon.com/thebittersweetlifepodcast. If you believe that artists deserve to be paid for their work, and this show is one that you love, please consider chipping in. There are links in the show notes, or click on support at thebittersweetlife.net. I'm sending out a whole pile of thank you cards to people who have supported this show in the past today. We will be more than grateful for your contribution, far more grateful than any major corporation. That is certain. Take a moment to look at the show notes, and if you can't afford to support the show, leave us a review wherever you listen. Welcome to Rome. This is The Bittersweet Life with Katie Sewell and Tiffany Parks. Hello, this is The Bittersweet Life. I'm Katie Sewell.
I'm Tiffany Parks.
Tiffany in Rome, Katie in Seattle. And today we're going to discuss the concept of going native, but maybe not in the way that it was typically defined back in the day. And I looked this up, Tiffany, just to give us the baseline. This is how the term came to be. And I'm going to just read you a tiny paragraph about it. Very tiny. It says, "The phenomenon of going native is one of the less commonly known outgrowths of European colonialism. It emerged as a result of the meeting of Europeans and indigenous cultures and drew its strength from the perceived differences between those cultures. The term refers to the desire of non-Aboriginals to identify with and immerse themselves into a native culture." So basically, as the Brits expanded across the globe, a certain percentage of them didn't want to stay separate from the area that they were moving to. They wanted to become a part of it. They wanted to adopt the customs and cultures of the place that they had moved to, referred to as going native. And but this is a topic you've been thinking about a lot. I guess I want to know what it is that you've been thinking. How does going native apply to you?
Well, the first time that I ever heard anyone use this term to apply to an expat as opposed to a colonialist was a friend of mine who does not live in Rome anymore, but an English woman, actually, who was living here for a long time. And we had a mutual friend who was a closer friend of hers. My friend had married an American, and before she was married, had always criticized jokingly my American culture and, you know, joked about the superiority of her British culture. And then she went and married an American man. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. The point is, we had this mutual friend who'd married an Italian. And this was before I had married Claudio, and maybe even before I had met him. And we were talking about this friend of ours, someone that was really more of an acquaintance for me. And she said, this person's name, let's just say Anne. That was not her name, but okay, just in case she listens to the podcast. Anne has totally gone native. I understood immediately what she meant, because it's not that hard to make that leap. But it was the first time I'd heard it in terms of, you know, an Anglophone expat who lived in Italy. And I guess what she meant by this was she didn't go to the pub anymore. You know, she didn't do those typical English things. She was maybe not wanting to hang out with her British friends or her other expat friends anymore. So, you know, be that as it may, I never really investigated that situation. But it did get me thinking. I've always kind of toyed with the idea in my mind, am I ever going to go native? Would I want to? To what extent would I go native? Is it desirable? Is it a good thing if you're a long-term expat / immigrant? Do you want to do that? Or do you want to hold on to your culture? Or do you want to find some happy medium? It's impossible to see yourself really from the outside. But I wonder, from the outside, do I seem like someone who has gone native or not? And in some cases, I think that I really have. And in some cases, I think I really haven't.
Just to get it clear, if we're talking about going native, I suppose it doesn't mean that you're ever fooling anybody who's from the culture that you're from the culture. You know, none of these British colonialists were, you know, really absorbed into Indian culture, and people were thinking, you know, that guy might be Indian. It's not so much that people couldn't tell the difference,
no,
but that you wouldn't seem that different to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, you're not fooling anyone for sure. But I think definitely there is a strong sense of wanting to fit in,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to be accepted. Even though, you know, in most cultures, and I hope that the United States is an exception. I feel like the United States can be an exception. But in most cultures, that foreign person is never going to be 100% accepted. Like, they're always going to be seen as a little bit different, as a little bit other. I think this is especially true in cultures like Italy, where there, you know, there's a strong national culture there. There is immigration, but, you know, maybe only in the last 70, 80 years. It's not a country founded on immigration like the U.S. So, yeah, I think that's a part of it. I mean, I think there's lots of good reasons that one would want to do that. You know, you want to fully emerge in the culture that you live in, especially if you don't have any plans to leave. But I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, yeah, like, who do you think you're fooling? You know, like, I don't know. I think it's an interesting phenomenon, because you can really look at it from both sides. You can look at it and, you know, think, wow, this person is so respectful of the culture in which they live that they have, you know, they're really making an effort to fully, you know, immerse themselves in the culture, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes it can be too much,
mm-hmm.
you know. For me, this happens when I meet American people who speak Italian to me. It happened at a wedding that I was at a year and a half ago. And I was sitting at, you know, you get sat at a table with, you know, sometimes people that you don't know, a couple people that you do know. And there was a woman sitting next to me who was a translator. She was Italian, and she translated literature from Italian to English. So clearly she spoke very good English. And we had started chatting, and I can't remember honestly what language we were chatting in. But then her friend showed up, and she was speaking in Italian to this friend of hers who was sitting on her other side. And so I just assumed that this friend was Italian, but there were other Americans at the table who I was clearly speaking English to. And so she heard me speaking English, and she could clearly hear from my voice that I was an American. And she just kept speaking Italian to me, to the point that I truly thought she was Italian. She had a very good accent, whatever. And it turned out she was American. And I was like, oh, I thought you were Italian. Why are you speaking Italian to me? And I just thought it was odd. And, you know, I know people who speak Italian to their children who are American. That is, I mean, I cannot get behind that. I just cannot. You know, and of course, there are times when I'm going to speak Italian to Aurelio on accident, or because he's with a friend and I don't want his friend to not understand what I'm saying. Or if we're in the middle of a family discussion and I just don't want to, like, maybe mix up the languages and make it very clear. But 99% of the time I'm speaking to my own child in English. Like, why would you not? And I just am shocked when I see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that more often than you would think.
It's interesting, though, because as you were telling that story, you know, the friend who's the translator, you said, I don't actually remember which language we were speaking in. And I wonder if that woman, you know, if she was to recount meeting you, if she would be like, I don't really remember which language we were speaking in.
I mean, maybe. I just remember that I was speaking Italian to her because I remember the moment in which I realized that she was American. And I kind of felt like an idiot. Like, why have I been speaking Italian to you? Like, you're from my country. Like, you know?
Yeah.
And I've been watching... One of the reasons that I've been thinking about this more often than not is because I follow a couple of American moms who live in Paris and of course who live here, and you know, they're really good at Instagram in ways that I'm not. And they talk a lot about daily life in, you know, their respective countries, you know, where they're living as expats. And one of them, like, opened up her fridge and she's like, this is what I take back from the States whenever I go, you know, and she's got her, like, taco sauce and she's got her barbecue sauce. I don't remember now, but it was like 3 million sauces in her fridge, like the bottled, like the salad dressing, like stuff you would see in an American supermarket that you could never find in France or in Italy. And she had all of this, and she had all her, like, you know, cake mixes and her pancake mixes. And I just thought, I would never even think of bringing that stuff back.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception maybe of like a bottle of root beer, like that, yes. I'm going to have a bottle of root beer when I go to the States because I can't get it over here. But, you know, even that, I don't seek it out the way that I used to. When I was first a new expat, I would always be like, I got to have a bottle of root beer. Yeah. Now I forget. I don't even think about it.
Yeah.
So I think in some ways I have gone native when it comes to food. I want to say that with a caveat, because I haven't become an Italian foodie like so many other expats who live here, fancy gourmet people who, you know, have cooking blogs and they're really, really into the food. You know, who, if you listen to this show, that's not really me. I mean, I like to eat well, but it's not a passion. Here's another one. I don't know how this happened, but it just happened. I cannot serve more than one thing at a time. Like, I can't do the plate with a spaghetti on half of the plate and then a piece of meat and a vegetable on the same plate. Like, it just, to me, it feels wrong. And that's not to say that if I'm in the States and someone serves me that, I mean, I'm not going to turn up my nose at it, of course. But for me, like cooking for my family or cooking for my child, the thought of putting it on the same plate, it just feels off. It just feels weird to me.
Okay. Well, a couple thoughts based on that. I think you not kind of missing the food from the United States as much anymore probably has more to say about the fact that you have gotten well past the part where you are uncomfortable living in this new country. Because I think a lot of that like food seeking stuff, that product seeking stuff, is trying to feel a little bit of home while you're still in a kind of foreign experience, you know, where you're just trying to soothe some of the ruffled feathers, so to speak, and yes. in seeking these things out. Like, I can remember being in Rome when I was living there and spending an extraordinary amount of money on quinoa, which I do like to eat here in the States and is so unusual in Rome and is so wildly expensive, therefore, that it makes like really no sense to spend that much money on quinoa, except that it was a meal that made it feel like, oh yeah, this is a familiar meal, one I used to like to eat at home, you know. Foodie-wise, knowing you and how you feel about food, you're never going to be a foodie regardless of what country you're in. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you would never run a food blog unless I gave you like $1 million and would like write me a food blog. Then you might be like, okay, maybe I'll get interested in food more than I actually am. But yeah, you're never going to be a foodie, I don't think. I do think that the example of only being able to serve one course at a time is actually a really good example, because that is so Italian to only serve one thing at a time. It's actually one of the things that, as a person who doesn't live there, drives me the most crazy about eating at Italian restaurants. That you can't get the damn salad before you're finished with the pasta. It's like, why would I want to finish my entire plate of pasta and then eat a bowl of salad? I want to eat the salad as I'm going, or I want to eat the salad first, quite honestly, so that I don't eat as much pasta.
Well, you can, Katie, you can order the salad first. Contrary to popular belief, there is no rule about ordering in the sense that you can say to them, I want the salad first. And actually, that's actually quite common to eat a salad as an appetizer.
Okay.
It's not as common to eat cooked vegetables as an appetizer. Those are usually on the side of your main course. But salads, yes, you can absolutely 100% ask for a salad to be brought first. And they won't look at you funny.
But doesn't it bother you? I guess it doesn't. I guess that's what you're saying, is it doesn't bother you. But doesn't it bother you that they won't bring the next course? I mean, unless you're out for a long, languishing meal and you have nowhere to be, doesn't it bother you that they like require you to finish a course before they bring you something else? If I finish an entire course, I'm not actually hungry for the other thing. I order two things to have some variety.
Well, maybe that's, yeah. But I think that that's your Americanism coming out there, because I think that when you eat, I have found in personal experience, when I'm eating two different things that have two different flavors at the same time, I can eat a lot more. My capacity just for the amount of food that I can get in is way higher. Whereas if I'm eating just one thing, and I think this is typical, I think this is across the board, you are going to get sick of that one thing sooner. And so if you eat your two courses separate from one another, you will the idea is eat less.
Because
when you go back, like, for example, if you're switching from savory to sweet, you are never going to get sated on that because the salt feeds in with the sweet and then that it feeds into the, and it's back and forth. And it's just like all the, you know, whatever neurons are exploding in your brain telling you like you're having this amazing taste sensation. You can't stop. When you eat your courses one at a time, you slow down, you focus on what you're eating, and you eat that until you don't want that thing anymore.
Yes.
Whether or not you finish, you can ask them to take it away before you're done, Katie. No one's going to force you to finish your plate of pasta. And if you have ordered a lamb chop and you want to eat that, you can just say, I'm finished with this. So I want to give you some agency when you're at an Italian restaurant. You do not, they are not in charge of you. Okay?
I think you overestimate my ability to.
You are the boss of what you eat.
I think you overestimate my ability to speak Italian. Because half the time they're just like, I don't even know what this woman wants. No clue. But anyway, I was going to ask you a totally different question about going native. So is there something that you do on a regular basis in Italy to, say, blend in, to feel like you are going along with the culture, the people, so that they feel like you're one of them that is still to this day, nearly 20 years of living there, terribly uncomfortable, or something that you just really don't like doing still?
Oh gosh, that's a hard one, because I mean, like, that really makes me uncomfortable. I generally don't do things or that really, really make me uncomfortable.
Well, or that just never quite feels right, you know? Like, you'll do it, but it would never be like how you would do it.
I mean, I think maybe one small example would be the writing of professional emails. You have to be so over the top formal when you write professional emails here. And it's hard for me. It's hard for me to do it because I just want to get to the point and not waste time. And, you know, so often I feel like, okay, if I just write it like that, it's going to seem really rude. So I have to, you know, put in the flourishes.
Like, give me an example of what some of the flourishes would be.
An example. If I were to like translate directly into English, I mean, it would be like, you are like, how do you even say si prega? Like, you are almost like you are supplicated to reply to this email at your earliest convenience. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. Or thank you for your gracious response to this email. Distinct salutations, Tiffany Parks. You know, that kind of thing. It's just, it's very, there's cordial salutations, there's distinct salutations. It's like, when do you use cordial and when do you use distinct? It's like, you know, it's hard to know. So yeah, it can be a bit over the top. And if it's an important enough email, Claudio will come and check it for me. It's never right. He's always like messing with it and fixing it.
That's so funny.
But there's that. And I would say dressing up, maybe getting like taking the effort to get dressed up. But I have to say that I've seen Italians slipping. They are not, I mean, but again, sometimes I think, who am I hanging out with? The other moms at the school? You know what I mean? I'm not on Via Condotti every day, you know, doing my shopping. So there, of course, women are going to get more dressed up, and women and men in the center in general. And I think in small towns, people get dressed up too. I don't think it's just a big city thing. But I have kind of, I would never have gone out in sweats 15 years ago. And I still don't go out in quote unquote sweats. But what I do all the time, if I'm just running an errand, like if I'm going to the supermarket or I'm going to pick up my son, I will go out in a pair of yoga pants. I mean, that's such a typical mom thing. It's like almost embarrassed to admit. But yoga pants and like a sweater. Okay, not a sweatshirt, a sweater, an actual sweater, but paired with leggings.
So, okay.
And sneakers.
That could be COVID as much as anything. I feel like everybody slipped a little bit too more informal.
Tiffany here, popping in to share with you a little slice of what it's going to be like on our Rome listener trip this coming October 2024. We're so excited to share our version of Rome with you, our secret, beautiful, and curated aspect of Rome. that Katie and I have come to love over the years. We want to share that with you guys because, quite frankly, there's nothing else like it. You're going to be waking up to the sound of birds chirping in the courtyard, the beautiful, lush, flowering courtyard right outside your window. You'll be staying at the Hotel Donna Camilla Savelli, which is a gorgeous early 17th century restored monastery designed by one of the greatest architects of all time, Francesco Borromini. You can have your breakfast in that lush, flowering courtyard with a little bubbling fountain in the background, sipping a cappuccino, having a warm, piping hot cornetto right out of the oven, and all sorts of other yummy treats. And then you'll be meeting up with Katie and myself and the rest of our very, very intimate group. Remember, this is just a very small, select group. We're going to have 10 rooms, and we're capping it at that. 2 people maximum per room. And we'll be heading out into the city, mostly on foot. We'll be exploring and sharing with you some of those things that we have discovered, some things that we are extremely passionate about, and quite frankly, some things that most Romans have never even heard of, much less seen. Just to give you an example, we'll be taking you to an absolutely exquisite little chapel that some people call the Sistine Chapel of the Middle Ages. So beautiful and so little known that when I took my father-in-law there this past summer, and he has lived in Rome for almost his entire life, at least 40 years, he had never even heard of this place, much less seen it. We're going to take you to a place where there are literally 3 levels of history, one on top of the other. And as you walk downstairs, not only are you walking back in time, but you can feel the weight of history on you and smell it in the air as you go underground to explore these places. Katie and I will be with you every single morning of the trip for 5 mornings as we go off, way off the well-trod tourist track in Rome. And we go to places where even though there are thousands and thousands of people in Rome, thousands of visitors, some of the places that we go will be almost completely alone. Works of art by some of the greatest painters and sculptors in history. I just cannot wait to share my passion and Katie's passion as well for these places and for these things with you, our listeners. So if that sounds like something that you'd like to do, if you want to escape from the mundane day-to-day for a delightful week, a magical week, in early October of 2024, then get in touch with us. The exact dates are the 6th to the 12th of October, 2024. Email us if you'd like more information. You can write to bittersweetlifepodcast@gmail.com. That's bittersweetlifepodcast@gmail.com. We hope to hear from you, and we hope to see you in Rome in October. Back to the show.
Okay, here's a totally different question. And this one might be hard to answer, too. What would you say, if you had to guess, was the first thing that people in it, living in Italy, traditional Italians, do that you adopted first? What do you think your first habit, your first example of going native was?
Gosh. First habit. Oh. Well, it definitely wasn't drinking coffee. Because I never did that. See, yeah, there's one of my many, or my few, perhaps, rebellions against Italian culture is that I have not adopted the coffee habit. And I think that I might be like the only expat in Italy who does not drink espresso. Mm-hmm. But you asked me what I did adopt.
Very first thing.
I can't. Using the bidet, perhaps. I very, very useful contraption, by the way. I don't know how I would live without it now. But I don't know. I never, ever used to blow dry my hair. I mean, ever. Mm. Ever. I hated doing it. I have a lot of hair. So it took a long time. Mm-hmm. And I never was good at it. Like I never, no one, like my big sister never taught me how to blow dry your hair to make it look good. You know, I never had, you know, no one taught me. And so I never learned how to style my hair. And I was lucky enough to have hair with body. And so I could just let it air dry and it would look okay, you know? Mm-hmm. So I never, ever, ever dried my hair unless, you know, special occasion. I don't know. That's got to be the first thing. I never, ever let my hair just air dry anymore, ever.
And do you think that's a distinctly Italian thing that they never do? Or is it something about the climate?
Absolutely. It's something that old-fashioned Italians and even young Italians, even my sisters-in-law, they will tell you, if you do not dry your hair, you will get sick.
Right.
Like, you could get really sick. You know, at the very least, you're going to get a really bad neck ache from having that cold, wet hair lying on your neck. And at the worst, you're going to get a head cold. Actually, it could be way worse. You could get pneumonia.
And that was something that you bought, like, first on. That was something that you were like, yes.
I didn't buy it. Okay. I didn't buy it. I don't know why I adopted it because I don't believe it. But I just do it now. I honestly, it's like to avoid the hassle of people being like, your hair's wet. Oh my God. I mean, like, it's so bad that, like, it's like almost akin to like going out without pants on. Like, people are like going to be shocked and they're going to tell you your face. Like, one time I was at the gym. It was like during the COVID times, right? It was 2020. It was, the gyms had reopened, but it was still like lots of restrictions. And one of the restrictions that they had made at the gym, and I mean, there must have been a reason behind it, like blowing of air, blowing germs around or something, but hair dryers were not allowed. So I had just taken a shower. I had washed my hair and I didn't realize until afterwards, no hair dryers. And so I was like, well, whatever, I'll just dry my hair at home. But I had to stop by my mother-in-law's to pick something up. And she lives very, very close to the gym. So I just walked from the gym to her house. Oh my gosh, I can't even tell you the drama that ensued when she saw my and my father-in-law, when they saw that I was out, and it was a rainy day as well. It was a rainy day, so it was like, oh my gosh, you're gonna die. She made me dry my hair at her house before I went home.
Yeah, I guess if you were receiving that sort of harassment about something, you would start to change your behavior. I mean,
yeah. And I have to say, there's another way that I've gone native. And I mean, like I said, for me, I think, and I mean, it's probably everyone is like this. I've got my different things. I've got the things that I staunchly resist, like the coffee drinking and, you know, keeping my kid up until midnight. Like, those are things I'll never do. But then I've got the things that I have totally adopted, like the hair drying, the bidet use, the separate courses. And one of the things that kind of against my will I have let slip in is this idea that a lot of cold air on your chest and neck can make you sick. Mm-hmm. This is something that all expats make fun of Italians for. They just laugh at them. And I used to laugh at them. But I have experienced it. And I mean, sure, I must have had a bug in my system. Okay, I know how germs work. I know that you don't just get sick from air.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, our bodies fight off a lot of these bugs that we just naturally pop up. I mean, we all come into contact with germs constantly, but we don't get sick every day, right? Mm-hmm. So our bodies know how to fight this stuff off. And maybe they've got something going on because maybe when the cold air is blowing on your neck, your defenses lower and you can get sick more. No, I know you're laughing at me. I feel like laughing at my, it has happened to me.
You know that this is like why when it's sweltering in August, you have next to no air conditioning anywhere.
That is not true, Katie. Everyone has air conditioning. Everyone I know has air conditioning, except people who live in extremely, extremely old buildings in the center of Rome where the building itself cannot support it. Everybody I know, everybody in my building was built with air conditioning in every room. We have air conditioning in every room. My very Italian husband keeps the air conditioning on until the 1st of November sometimes if it's warm enough.
Okay, but even still, like, you know, just because you happened to get sick when that happened once doesn't mean that it actually is true.
I don't know. I was on a motorino and it was April. And, you know, I was dressed for like the springtime. I had on this like little light blazer, like a V-neck sweater and no scarf. And I was on the motorino with a woman she was giving me like a Vespa tour of Rome. So we were going all over the city and it was kind of getting colder as we went. It was evening time. And Claudio used to have a motorino and I used to just hug him and cuddle up with him and I wouldn't get cold, but I was sitting kind of back because, you know, it was this woman I barely knew. So I'm going to like embrace her the entire time. And I just kept feeling this cold air hitting my chest. And sure, I swear to you, Katie, the next day I got sick and I got the worst case of bronchitis. I mean, terrible. I was sick for like, you know, those sicknesses like the one you had last year. I was sick for like 6 weeks.
What if it was the mere suggestion that you had like the whole time you're feeling this cold air on your chest?
But I didn't believe in it then. I didn't believe in it. I used to laugh at people. This was ages ago.
Well,
this was many, many years ago. I don't know. I just feel like sometimes I think, and I mean, I will never agree with the idea that swimming after eating can make you die, which my husband totally believes. But I do think that in some cases, these old traditional wisdom, Katie, it has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true. It does come from somewhere.
So there must be some nugget of truth in it.
I mean, the thought about not swimming after eating is because people used to believe that if you ate then swam, you would get a cramp and your muscles would seize and you would
drown. That's not what Italians believe.
Well,
that is not what Italians believe.
That's the American version of it then.
That has nothing to do. That's the American version. It's the first half hour after eating. Italians believe it's called, they have a word for it, congestion, but it has nothing to do with nasal congestion. But they believe, and it's like if you have a big meal, right? Like if you have like a sandwich, no problem. But if you're having like a big Italian lunch, actually the first half an hour is almost okay because you haven't started, your digestion process hasn't really started. But it's from like a half an hour to 2 hours after. They believe, I should ask Claudio exactly what it is because he can explain it to me. He can't make it make sense, but he can try. It has something to do with your digestive process. Okay, it's like your whole body is using the blood of your body to digest. But then because that is happening, you can suddenly lose like the function of your other limbs. I don't know, something like that.
I don't know.
It really has nothing to do with muscle cramps. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. So
I don't know.
Okay. Let's say you have mostly gone native at this point, right? What would you say is the one thing that you just feel like you'll never blend into Italian society because of XYZ?
I think it's got to be the coffee thing. Coffee culture is such a part of Italian culture and I don't have it. And I feel it a lot. Like I feel it when I go to a cafe and they don't know how to make tea properly. And I have to explain to them, like, can you give me like more than like a centimeter of water? Like, you know, they give you this tiny teacup and they fill it up one third of the way. It's like not even enough for one cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like tepid, the water's tepid and they give you the tea bag separately. Like, you know, or I went to the supermarket and my supermarket has recently been completely redone. They changed everything around. And for a couple of weeks there, I couldn't find the loose tea. And I was kind of freaking out. I kept thinking every week, I'd think, okay, it's going to be back. It's going to be back. Finally, I asked one of the ladies there and, you know, she couldn't understand. She's like, oh, but look at all this tea. And there is a lot, you know? And I'm like, no, like the loose tea. You know, imagine you went to the supermarket and all you could find were the little capsules and you couldn't find the actual loose coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, yeah. I get it. That's what it's like for you, of course. thinking I was English, probably.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, maybe that. I mean, there's a lot of little things. I'll never speak the language like a local, but that's okay. I have a couple of friends who speak Italian really well, probably the same as me, I would say, as far as the grammar and the vocabulary. But they work really hard to capture the Italian accent,
mm-hmm.
to such an extent that they really sound like they're Italian. I never had that ambition. I don't want to sound terribly American. I don't want to, you know, talk with like, you know, really strong R's and not roll my R's and not, you know, not create proper vowels. Obviously, I want to speak it in the proper way, but I don't need to, like, I feel like some people try to fake the Italian accent. Like mm-hmm. if you listen to Arnold Schwarzenegger and you listen to Arnold Schwarzenegger at the beginning of his career mm-hmm. and he has this strong German accent and you listen to him now, he almost has no accent. And it's kind of like, oh, it was kind of nice, that German or Austrian accent. It was kind of, you know, it's kind of charming. And now you barely have any accent.
Well, to be
I feel like it's kind of a pity.
Yeah, but to be fair, he's like lived here way longer than you've been in Italy. So it'll be interesting to see if over time you get more and more Italian accented as well. Who knows?
Maybe.
Who knows?
I kind of feel like my Italian in general has plateaued. I kind of feel like I'm not going to get any better. I've gotten to the point where I can get, although I'm learning so much with Aurelio being in school, you wouldn't believe. Mm. I'm learning the passato remoto, which is a tense I never knew before. And so I'm learning that.
Wow.
It's the literary tense, Katie. It's the old, it's the like way back in the past.
Wow.
And it's not used in really spoken Italian. So I'm learning that right now.
Give us an example of a word.
Fu. Fu means was. Like la luce fu. There was light. It's very, very long time in the past. I mean, it could be 5 years. It doesn't have to be like millennia in the past. It could be 5 years in the past. You're talking about something that you did, a memory of something that you did. But it's usually when you're talking about like history or when you're reading a book, like a novel, usually they use that tense.
Interesting. Okay. Boy, this is a very, very rich topic. I mean, even as I mean, we could practically do a whole other episode, because even as you're thinking about this, I was thinking about you being shamed into drying your hair very quickly after moving there. Because I was thinking, well, when we talked, you said you wanted to talk about the idea of going native. It's blatantly obvious that I never went native in living in Italy. I wasn't there long enough. I didn't even have a prayer of going at all native. But so I thought, well, maybe I've never had any experience with this at all. But at the same point, and maybe this is a topic for another day, I do have an experience with it, because we're moving from the Midwest of the United States to the West Coast of the United States. What did I learn to lose and learn to lose very quickly? My Midwestern accent. There you go. And everybody's...
I mean, you were a little child, though.
But everybody...
I mean, you were young.
But everybody doesn't believe, like, oh, you used to have a Minnesotan accent? And I said, yeah, not only did I used to have one, I used to have a very strong one. And now I do not. That did not happen overnight.
Do your parents?
My parents were from the East Coast, so they did not.
Right.
Although there are certain... Right. My dad does have an accent on certain words because he's from Western Pennsylvania. And my mother was actually from New Jersey, so she had an accent of her own on certain words. And I think all of us have learned to change in the years that we have lived here in Seattle. And it didn't take like years and years, but it did take a concerted effort. And part of the reason why I did that was because the kids in my elementary school made fun of my accent so severely. You just sort of set about figuring out, like, how am I different? Because to me, I didn't really know I had an accent, because everyone talked the way I talked from where I came from. So,
of course.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Huh. It is. I thought of something else, Katie, that I'll never, ever accept.
Okay.
Italians iron everything. When I say everything, I mean everything. They iron their sheets, which I can't understand. They say it makes them softer, which, okay, I can maybe get that. When you hang up your sheets outside, they are a little stiff. But I mean, wow, that's a huge effort just for a little bit of softer sheets. Because no one's going to see if they're wrinkly. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They're under the covers.
Yeah.
And I have this other mom in the building whose son goes to Aurelio's school and is a couple years older. And she kind of gives me his old clothes, just like I give Aurelio's old clothes away to people with younger kids. And she's like, oh, these are all washed and ironed. And she's like holding t-shirts. I'm like, ironed his t-shirts? I don't even ask anymore, though, because I know that people do this. They iron their children's t-shirts. I don't know what kind of time you have, lady, but I mean, I can't even, it just boggles my mind, the idea of ironing a child's t-shirt.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I should mention, for those of you listening who have never been to Italy before, I mean, one thing that's also very interesting and sort of odd about if you were to move to Rome is that more than likely you would not have a dryer. And so we we think about, like, well, why would, you know, you don't have to hang your sheets outside, just throw them in the dryer. That'll make them nice and soft and warm. But no, no, no. Everything you wash, you have to hang up and have hanging around your apartment, which is another thing that I'm sure you get used to, but that is a bit trying when you first start. But that's not what the topic of this show
is
about.
It's really annoying in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a problem in the summer, especially if you have an outdoor place to hang your clothes. And your clothes last a lot longer if you don't put them in the dryer.
Yeah, I get that. But yes, you're right. In the winter, it's like your underwear is hanging in the middle of your living room for the whole week because it takes so long to dry. anyway,
yes,
all right.
It's,
well,
it's challenging.
We should leave it there. That was a lot of fun, though. If you yourself live abroad in a country other than the one you were born in, and you feel like you have examples of going native, feel free to send us a story or two. Perhaps we'll do another episode about this very rich and fun topic. You can always send us an email to bittersweetlifepodcast@gmail.com. Or you can also find us on social media. Just search for the Bittersweet Life Podcast. We're mostly on Facebook and Instagram now. And and until next time, this is The Bittersweet Life. I'm Katie Sewell.
I'm Tiffany Parks.
Join us again. Bye.
The Bittersweet Life is produced and edited by me, Katie Sewell. My co-host is Tiffany Parks. Send us a note through the Contact Us page at thebittersweetlife.net. Also, you could sponsor this show and reach thousands of engaged thinkers and travel lovers all over the world. Send us a note at thebittersweetlife.net to get the conversation started. Our logo is designed by Jody Rick at The Lost Laboratory, web help from Drew Atkins. And this show continues when listeners support it. Tell a friend to subscribe, write us a review, and like you would with any other art you appreciate, tip your podcaster. Don't steal the tea. Find ways to toss a donation in the hat at thebittersweetlife.net.